good morning, everyone, or morning, afternoon, wherever it is in the world that you are listening to today's podcast. This is Mastering Risk Management. It's our latest episode. I'm Anthony Wilson, and welcome back to the program. Today we have a very special guest, and I know I say that all the time, but they are all very special guests, and they all bring some wonderful insight into risk and associated areas. Today we have David Lloyd. Now, David is the Regional Claims Manager for Australasia and ASEAN for HDI Global SE. Now, if, like me, you're not sure who HDI Global SE is, I'm sure David can elaborate for us in a little bit. But let me first introduce David and go through his bio. So he's worked in London and the Australian market for over 30 years. He's worked predominantly in the area of liability, professional indemnity, financial lines, and medical malpractice space, along with other lines of business. As lead underwriter for the market, David has managed many of Australia's largest liability claims, including the Black Saturday bushfire class action in Victoria, which was Australia's largest class action settlement. He worked for Lloyd's Syndicate 386, which is where I actually first met David and later became QBE Europe, for 24 years as their claims director in Australia, and more recently, the head of technical claims at Zurich. In October this year, he joined HDI Global as their regional claims manager for Australasia and ASEAN. So, welcome, David.
Thank you. Thank you for asking me.
Not a problem at all. It'd be great to get an insurer's perspective of the world. So, lovely to have you along. So, I guess, first up, tell us about you, your career path, how you got into insurance and claims management and all those exciting things.
I started off in insurance in London back in 1984-85. My father was an insurer.
Yeah.
He was an underwriter.
Yeah.
It didn't sound that exciting when he talked about it. It was just something that was always a conversation at the dinner table, and I thought, gee, that doesn't sound that exciting. I'd finished at school, I'd finished at college. Whilst I was at college, I did some holiday work at that insurer.
Yeah.
And in the end, I did some summer holiday work, and I'm still on summer holiday work. I never went back to my studies, and I just stayed. I think it was the attraction of having money in your pocket rather than being a poor student that really won over.
Right.
And the GA, the general accident in the UK, it was one of those great insurers that had a big commercial corporate arm.
Yeah.
But it put people on rotation through the departments.
Yep.
And I'd done some motor underwriting, which is what my father did. I actually quite enjoyed that because I was interested in cars.
Yes.
I did some accident liability underwriting. That was okay. And then one day I was down talking to one of our liability claims handlers, and he had a big thick fat pile of papers on his desk, and I asked him, what's that?
Yep.
And he said, well, it's a claims file. I said, but what of? And he said, oh, it's an industrial deafness claim, employer's liability industrial deafness.
Right.
And I said, well, tell me about it.
Yep.
What is that? And he started explaining it to me, and he showed me all these lawyers' reports and everything else, and that was the light bulb moment. That's
right.
When I went back to, well, it was personnel department, it wasn't an HR department.
Yes.
But it was when I went back to personnel department and said, you don't need to keep putting me around the departments now, I found it, I'm a claims guy.
Right.
So I stayed in claims, the general accident, for a number of years to the late 80s. I had a year as a broker, and realised after probably 2 weeks I wasn't going to be a broker.
Right.
And I'd been employed by this broker to really act and challenge insurers for some of their larger clients, some of the indemnity issues that came up. The problem was that a lot of their policies were actually with the general accident, so I was trying to run the counter argument to something I had actually been semi-indoctrinated with. Previously. So that wasn't successful. During that time I met now my wife.
Yep.
And we moved here in 1992.
Right.
And as you said, I joined the 386 syndicate then, and it was in Melbourne for the first 2 years, and then 94 onwards I've been in Sydney.
That makes you local, I'm very local.
Yeah, I actually travel on an Australian passport.
Excellent.
Which gets quizzed when I go into Britain each time, but there we go.
So it sounds like a little bit you've fallen into the insurance market, as it were, but the bug's bitten and you've stayed ever since, which is great. So claims management, I suppose it's something that not everybody understands the fine detail of. So tell us, you know, what are the key responsibilities? You know, what's the good things? What really gets you excited and jumping out of bed in the morning to get into the job? And what are the things that are maybe a bit more of a challenge?
I think people in the claims world, you've got to reflect the business's values.
Yeah.
Because that is actually where they're seen. Your touch point with clients is probably far greater than it is with the underwriters.
Yes.
And it's where, you know, the tire hits the road. On that product that the client bought. So you've got to deliver on that commitment, but you've also got to recognise that when an insured comes to you with a claim, it is kind of their hour of need.
Yes.
It's when, you know, particularly when it's a professional indemnity or financial lines issue. It's when they have something much more personal in the corporate world than just, say, a worker-to-worker injury that's on site.
Yes.
And you've got to be able to support them in their hour of need. There are the four, I call the four R's in claims management, being relationships, managing the reserves, managing the reinsurance, and helping with the risk management.
Right.
You know, a good underwriter will learn an awful lot from their technical claims guy.
Yes.
And try and marry that together from what they've been presented by the client and the broker.
Yeah.
So they can say, well, our history says this is what's happening in your business.
Yes.
But what you, the client, are presenting to me at renewal is slightly different.
Yes.
So where is this dichotomy?
Help me understand that.
Yep. We want to understand that because we want the relationship. We want to continue it.
Yes.
And I think on the putting those two things together, and then we've got to look at the internal side, which is the reserving and the reinsurance. One of the things you've got to sometimes push back on within an insurer is that when you make a reserve recommendation on a large claim, for everybody else in the business to remember, you're the claims handler making the reserve recommendation. You're not actually to blame for the accident.
Yes, yes.
And there's been the odd occasion where I've had to remind people that it wasn't me that actually wrote the risk.
Yeah.
I'm just the chap running around in the background trying to tidy something up.
Yes.
I think resolving indemnity early, so that client who's bought the product knows where they stand. They know that they've got indemnity, sure. They don't have to put any allocation on their own P&L for a potential uninsured loss.
Yes.
And many insurers come up with challenging claims. You know, and they fit within the policy just about.
Yes.
There's a nuance to them. There's a difference to them. There are no two claims are the same.
No, absolutely.
Now, there are some that are similar, but there's none two that are the same.
Yes.
So you have to learn from those experiences. So for me, it's finding a solution. You know, I don't think you need to be a technical zealot to be able to do black lettering of claims management. You need to have the experience and the confidence of saying, well, I can find you that solution.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of insurers talk about putting the customer first. Too many insurers are actually held back by governance and compliance.
Yes, yes.
So the hands-on technical time on a file is becoming less and less at some insurers.
Right.
So and certainly what we do here is we advocate technical excellence. It's to be able to give the the handler as much time to be able to dedicate to the customer's claim, the client's claim.
Yeah.
When I look around the market, I can identify who I think our competitors are, and say, look, they are our competitors because their technical skills are very good.
Right.
Very good.
Yeah.
And that's that balance, that trying to find the balance between having excellent technical skills and being overly compliant and saying, well, we're performing really well because we're ticking all the boxes.
Yeah.
But they're just internal boxes and not actually putting the customer first.
Yeah.
And some of that goes around to putting pressure and savings in claims departments.
Yes.
There's this natural desire to try and find savings within claims, headcount pressures, and trying to squeeze as much out of it as possible. So you're dealing with a lot of what the measurables are, and a lot of what, you know, in claims is quite a large proportion that are immeasurable. And that scares people.
Yes.
Because we operate in the financial industry.
Yeah.
You've got to have something that's measurable. So when you put some of that together, there's this risk of dumbing down skills. Dumbing down technical excellence. And the test probably partly is if you're looking to recruit, you know in your mind who in the market for that role you would actually approach.
Yes.
But in the last 10 years, if that was, say, 10 years ago, you'd think, well, there's 10 people I would look at for that specific role.
Yeah.
It's probably now 5.
Yeah. Wow.
Because I think it's being dumbed down to an extent, and therefore it's creating a bit of a brain drain. And that's a slight concern, and some of that is around that, well, you know, there was an influx of lawyers into claims departments, which was excellent.
Yes.
It was the right thing to do. Get the balance.
Yes.
Okay. Some of your old school technical guys and some lawyers. You get the balance in your teams, and that works. But I think some of them have now left the industry because they're not actually hands-on technical claims.
Yeah.
They're being distracted by these other things.
Yeah.
On the negative, I think. There is a blame culture,
right,
within society. So as soon as something happens, someone is to blame.
Yes.
And invariably, when there is someone to blame, there's an insurer sitting behind them.
Yes.
For whatever occurred.
Yep.
And you know, between them and us will be plaintiff lawyers.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think managing plaintiff lawyers is an art that you have to develop over time. You've got to be able to make sure that the lawyers you've retained aren't playing the man, they're playing the ball.
Exactly.
You've got to make sure that they're actually an extension of your business, representing your client's best interests and not worrying too much about it's another claim by this firm and we're going to teach them a lesson.
Yeah,
that's a dangerous road. I mean, I do believe in karma, and when you look around what's happening with some plaintiff law firms at the moment,
yes,
there's a fair bit of karma out there.
Absolutely.
So you've just got to be patient and let that happen. I think plaintiffs can unfortunately become pawns in a game.
Yes. Yes.
And when they become pawns in a game, if someone in the outside world, i.e. the non-insurance environment, a non-risk management environment, they ask you to explain something, it's actually very hard to explain why a claim takes 3 years to settle.
Only
settles because all of a sudden we got Judge so-and-so and everyone said, oh, this isn't, he's not going to be a good draw for us, or she's not going to be a good draw for us, therefore we've got to settle.
Yeah.
That's a really hard conversation to have someone in the outside world.
Absolutely.
But the plaintiff lawyers have to do that to their clients.
Yes, yes.
But what are the statistics for plaintiff or for those claims settling just before the door of a court?
Yeah.
For fairly cynical reasons.
Yeah.
There are examples, and this was on the public record because it was in the Australian, so I can mention it.
Yeah.
The Victorian bushfires, 18 months after that settlement, the plaintiffs hadn't seen any
really.
So that's on the public record, but that's a reasonable example of why not.
Yeah.
And explain it.
Yeah.
That law firm came up with a reason, and once it was identified, I understand payments were made quite quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So one of our challenges is our plaintiff lawyers. And I've had claims, probably in recent time, I had another profile one in recent time, where it was one of those rare ones where the plaintiff lawyer left a fair bit of money on the table.
Yeah.
And that was one of those ones of saying, actually, that person who's injured is worth more.
Yes.
You've underdone them.
Yes.
It kind of doesn't quite balance up with the ones where we've had to pay too much because of whatever reason.
Yeah.
But I think being able to manage plaintiff lawyers is one area that's a challenge for everyone.
Yeah. And it's quite a distraction for the business too. I remember being involved in my previous life, and I think there was a financial crimes thing, and the offence was in 1996, and I came into the risk role in 2006, and it was still going. And we eventually got it done, but it was exactly as you said, more a battle of the lawyers rather than a commercial.
So that raises another issue, because It's that point of, in claims management, making sure that you as the insurer has ownership of the claim.
Absolutely.
You know, so again, it goes to the technical excellence of empowerment.
Yeah.
Is that decision maker within the business empowered to make it?
Yeah.
Are they comfortable enough within the business of saying, actually, this is $1 million loss?
Yeah.
And that's a red flag
to
someone,
and
all of a sudden they're going to start being challenged.
Yeah.
And if they turn around and say, oh, well, my lawyer says this, it's not the right answer. The answer is, I've read the advice, I agree with it, or I'm going to challenge it on this.
Absolutely.
Can they make those decisions themselves? If they're outsourcing their intelligence, which some do. Then
becomes a problem.
It's a problem because they're not representing their kind.
Absolutely. Well, David, a little bit about HDI. So it's a global firm, and it's a big firm.
It is.
But it's probably not as well known in Australia as some others. So maybe just a bit of background: who HDI is, what they do, all those sort of things.
HDI is a German mutual insurer. Out of Hanover. It was established in 1903. HDI stands for Haftpflicht Deutschen Industrie.
Right.
So liability. Haftpflicht is German for liability. So
right.
It's liability German industry.
Right.
Our sister company is Hanover Re.
Ah, okay.
All out of the Talanx group.
Yes.
And it's a 30 billion euro business with 20,000 staff worldwide. We have offices in around 37 countries, but through our international programs and partnerships, we're in over 130, 140 countries.
Wow.
So whilst it was a heavily German-based company, or we've got 14 branches in Germany, its geographical spread has grown. In Australia, we were... we essentially took on Girling. Girling became part of the group, and then we were HDI Girling here, and then last year we rebranded to HDI Global.
Right.
And so Girling went into runoff in Australia back in the 2000s.
Yes.
Then in 2010, Stefan Feldman came in as the managing director for here.
Right.
We had a business of $6 million Aussie dollars then.
Right.
And this year we're going to be just tipping over 100 million.
Wow.
So we've been on a
big trajectory,
good growth.
Yep.
But because of our background, the industrial background,
yep.
Very typically German industrial businesses that are part of the mutual, like Daimler, BASF, Volkswagen, Siemens, right. and the like, are right. part of that mutual. So, yep. And they've been part of the mutual since day one.
Yes, yeah.
So it's a very industrially focused business,
yep.
And that's where the growth has been able to develop.
Yeah.
Here, primarily leading in the property, engineering, construction space, liability, D&O, marine, and then we've got our international programs
right.
as well. So it's a broad, yeah. Diverse corporate book,
yeah.
It has an impressive client base.
Mm, absolutely, but, absolutely.
Yeah, so it's quite a good success story. Really.
Very impressive, very impressive. Well, thank you. So I guess insurance and risk management go hand in hand. You can't have one without the other. So where did you first get exposed to the responsibilities of risk management in your career? How did you first come across the discipline?
I think I would have been about 20 years old, working in London, and I was sitting with one of our liability underwriters at the time, and a broker brought in this risk. And the risk was the employer's liability and public liability, or workers' comp as it is here,
yeah.
For writing a Channel Tunnel. Now, I can't remember if he was looking for primary terms or excess layer terms, right. or anything else, but one of the things that they said, they went through all the contracts and how the contracts would work, and it was a consortium,
yep.
And they were I remember them discussing all of that and how the consortium's all part of the risk and there's no other policies, so it was all contained within the risk.
Right.
But then they got on to the risk management side and who had responsibility for that, how that would work, and what sort of injuries were they expecting. And they went through the injuries, and there'll be the typical, what we call here, worker-to-worker injury, worker-on-site injury.
Yep.
And then the broker said, he said it quite as a matter-of-fact way, he said, and the projected fatality tolerance is 24. Which worked out as one fatality per mile.
Wow.
Which, when you... Yeah, exactly.
That's, shake your head.
When you look back on that,
yeah.
It's where we are now in a zero harm.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
You know, the whole... And it just made such a big statement to me in my mind of...
Yeah.
Conceptually, I struggled with it. I still do to an extent.
Yeah, yeah.
Of how could you knowingly ride a risk... regardless of premium, I suppose, knowingly write a risk where you accepted as part of it the fact that there would be 24 fatalities or a tolerance of 24. Mm-hmm. Now, I can't remember what happened if they actually reached 24, whether it was a rewrite or whether it was an additional premium. They're not going to stop the project.
No.
And I know there was an inquiry afterwards because there were about 12 fatalities.
Right.
Eight British and four French.
Right.
I'm not sure what that says about who did more work, who had the best risk management or anything else.
Yeah.
But on the tolerance basis it only got to about 50%.
Yes.
So
yeah.
But
so it was never tested. Yeah.
It was never tested.
Yeah.
But I do know, because I was trying to get the figures the other day, but there was a government inquiry afterwards into why there were so many.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they happened at the initial stages through the boring process, but as a risk management part, that was sort of my first awareness of risk.
Yes. Yeah,
And an acceptance of it, or probably a lack of acceptance of it, I suppose, to an extent.
Yes,
of how that may transpire when you're writing a risk.
Yeah, yeah, it's a very human toll there.
Yeah,
literally. Yeah. All right. No, thanks for that. So the insurance industry itself, I mean, I think, you know, those working in risk management probably have a reasonable understanding. But what do you think the understanding of the insurance industry is outside our environment?
I think, sort of, as I alluded to earlier, when you're trying to explain the claims litigation process to an outsider, it's very hard.
Mm.
They don't get it.
Yeah.
And I'm self-consciously aware that no matter how hard or how well you think you're explaining it, you're probably not doing it justice. You're not really doing it extremely well. On the evening of HIH collapsing, I was in a lift with Michael Pascoe, the journalist.
Yes.
And we both managed junior rugby teams in the north, on the North Shore.
Right.
We were going off to a district meeting, and I said to him, I just said to him, oh, big day today, you know, HIH. I said, a big corporate collapse like that, we're going to be talking about that for another 10 years. As it happens, we're 16 years later, we still are. The next day in his article, he started off saying the collapse of HIH is the type of corporate collapse we'll be talking about for another 10 years. I thought, oh, thanks, Michael. Nice to be quoted.
Yes.
But when I read his article, I thought, you don't understand insurance.
Yeah.
You don't understand that that a successful insurer, what that actually means, and that you need a successful insurer. It's been like when insurers make a profit, it's frowned upon.
Yeah.
In the same way as banks make profits. Now, banks make bigger profits.
Yes.
And that's frowned upon.
Yeah.
Ignoring the fact that insurers and banks are two of the economic pillars you need for society to be sustainable.
Yes.
Whenever there is an event, there is an insurer involved in it one way or the other.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the GFC would have been a lot worse but for insurers.
Yeah.
The storms in America.
Yeah.
The rebuild but for insurers.
Yeah.
Cyclone Debbie. But for insurers being there, we wouldn't be able to rebuild as quickly.
Yeah.
You know, you and I touched upon before we started talking about Bali.
Yes, yeah.
Travel insurance.
Yes.
You know, a volcano like that, there's going to be an insurer behind it.
Yes.
The other time it really got highlighted was with the Brisbane floods.
Yes.
Now, the Insurance Council of Australia's figures said that 98.5% of all claims were settled within 6 months.
Wow.
But if you actually followed what the newspapers said, Courier Mail and Australian, Hedley Thomas in the Australian, you would never have known that.
No, no.
But we probably weren't that good at getting those statistics out there.
Yeah.
So as far as most people concerned, the Brisbane floods was a bit of a disaster.
Yeah.
But in terms of the domestic insurance market, it was actually, and well, the ICA, it was actually a pretty good news story.
Yes.
But the media is not interested in a good news insurance story.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think the HIH collapse really showed that made people think there was an entitlement to insurance. You know, people couldn't get insurance because of this.
Yes.
Or it's going to be increased cost.
Yeah.
Well, that's logical.
Yeah.
One of my son's schools, when they were in year 10, I think it was, 9 or 10, the curriculum advisor wrote to all the parents in the year, said, if you want to come in and talk to the pupils about your profession, career, your occupation and everything else. And I thought, if we go in and talk to them about public liability, that's not really going to be that exciting. So I had a friend who's a lawyer, and he's in child in that year as well. So I spoke to him and said, well, why don't we do a double act?
Yep.
I'll talk about what the insurance part of it is and explain risk and how we manage reserving and how we manage this. You do the lawyer part and we'll sex it up a bit and make it a bit interesting and a few funny tales around it. You know, we'll pick an example claim.
Yep.
And I just got this note back saying, thanks, we'll be in touch. And really? I'm still waiting. Eight years later. But what annoyed me probably more is that the people I saw who had been invited to come in.
Yes.
And I thought, you really don't understand insurance, do you? Because in Britain, where I was obviously brought up, you were told to get into banking, finance, law, insurance.
Yeah.
It was one of those four things you go into, but it's not. I don't think it's promoted that way.
Yeah.
It's not understood here. I think it's still. I'm still slightly reserved when people say, "Oh, what do you do?"
Yeah.
Oh, I'm in insurance. Because they want to complain about their car insurance or size of their excess on their home insurance or something like that.
And it's challenging, isn't it? Because as people, we think about insurance probably twice, you know, once when we pay the premium and twice if we ever have to make a claim.
Yeah, it's a grudge buy. On a personal level, it's a grudge buy.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
And then when something large happens, and I think, you know, Brisbane floods or cyclones or whatever it is, the numbers are so large, you know, that the insurance industry manages it and manages it as a matter of course.
Yeah.
But as an individual, those numbers are so large, they're almost beyond comprehension.
Yeah.
And I think that's why, you know, it's very hard for them to understand. And the corporate buyers hopefully are a bit more mature and understand it a bit better. That, yeah, no, it's a challenge. You mentioned HIH and that was a significant event in the Australian landscape. So risk management as a result probably got a bit of a kick in the pants and had to change as a result of that. What from an insurance manager's or a claims manager's perspective, how is risk management viewed today? You know, is it has that made corporates more focused on risk? Or?
Yeah, I think it was a huge event. And perhaps some of the risk management processes pre-HIH probably weren't to the standard.
Yeah.
And the accountability within businesses changed within days,
right.
Weeks, months.
Yeah.
And we saw a complete mindset shift.
Yes.
In risk management. And the purchase of it, so they went for security.
Yeah,
you know the security ratings of every insurer was scrutinised.
Yeah,
there was an investment in the risk management process, so there wasn't just a single risk manager. There were assistants. They split roles and duties, and the risk manager no longer became perhaps a facility for between finance and the businesses and the insurer and the brokers.
Yes.
Actually got elevated into a higher level of accountability.
Yes.
And risk management within the business down to workers on site.
Yes.
Changed.
Yes.
Because I think it became accepted that you could no longer just use insurers as a bank for your laziness,
yes,
your
yeah.
lack of risk management.
Yes.
You actually had to take on financially your own risk.
Yep, risk. Absolutely.
And that probably was one of the bigger changes. So that you had that fiscal responsibility change, as well as corporate responsibility.
Yeah.
And I two stories from around that time, I remember one risk manager saying to me, "I just want my insurer to be there when I have a claim." He said it quite plaintively.
Yes.
Of, is it really so hard?
Yeah.
But he said it sitting next to his broker, and that just made it hard for me because he'd had the HIH, the independent, and the underwriter, all three collapsed within about two and a half years of each other.
Yeah, yeah.
And but he had about 5 years worth of uninsured claims.
Yes.
So that was quite hard. And I remember another risk manager saying that when they tried to explain why they had so many labour hire or contract workers on site, and this was back around that time, he said, "Well, because if we kill them, we don't have to close down the site. Because back then, you only had to close it down if it was a workers', workers' comp.
Yeah.
And that was, again, a bit of a red flag of,
not... How serious is the risk?
How serious are you at this?
Yeah.
But I think as you then have to look at that, how it's evolved in the last 16 years.
Yes.
And as I said earlier, it moved really quickly. And when you look around the globe now and you see Australian businesses, you see their cranes in London.
Yes, yes.
You see them everywhere else, shopping centres, other construction sites.
Yeah.
And you look at them and you think, risk management is now at a different level.
Yes.
And the Australian risk management is now recognised as a world leader.
Yeah, yeah.
I think the standard is extremely high.
Yeah.
It's very, very well regarded. And with that is better risk and better claims exposure.
Yes.
The focus that is now on contracts, the focus of how liabilities, responsibilities are shared or moved to another party, and it's clear and it's an accepted practice, is something we as an insurer look at straight away.
Yeah.
How much risk are you retaining? How much are you trying to move?
Yeah.
What is this for us? What is this limit you cover to?
Yeah. Yeah.
Of course, we've all seen when lawyers have come in and tried to say, well, that's not what you meant, and you meant to say, I think now it is reflected in the claims experiences for many of those companies that operate globally.
Yes.
It makes it easier when they go to market that they have such a sound.
It's good to see, isn't it, that you know, an organisation is prepared to back themselves in and their risk management by taking on more of the exposure. Because as an insurer, that must feel pretty good to be able to say, well, they're prepared to back themselves.
Absolutely.
We're absolutely prepared to be a party to this. And, you know.
Absolutely. Identify them. You think of some of those companies, even 10 years ago, wouldn't have a global risk manager.
No.
They do now.
Yes. Yeah.
Because it works.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah,
and I think that's where you can looking at them, you say, well, that's success.
Yes, it's absolutely headed in the right direction. Yeah. You mentioned just then too, David, the client, the broker, and the insurer sitting around. What are the essential elements in a relationship, particularly between the organisation and the insurer, but in the parties that are involved in this, what's got to be there to make it work and be successful?
I think it's on the underwriting side and on the claim side. It has to be trust and consistency.
Yeah.
It's consistency of your underwriting appetite, consistency of your rating.
Yes.
So you're in there for the long-term relationship rather than a knee-jerk, or you had a bad year last year, therefore this is going up.
Yeah.
Because you could move that business. The broker would probably be able to find a cheaper insurer most renewals if you really wanted to.
Yes.
But I think, corporately now we're much more astute in our insurance purchases.
Yes.
But also it's got to be trust. You've got to be able to trust the insurer that you're working with.
Yes.
You've got to be engaged with them to the level that when they say we're not sure on this type of risk or this extension, or we're not comfortable with your claims exposure in this area because we think this is going to happen. If you've got that trust, you can have a proper conversation.
Absolutely.
If you don't have that trust, it becomes, are you trying to squeeze out this?
Absolutely, yeah.
Oh, what is your message?
Absolutely.
And it's not. The message is quite clear.
Yes.
We're trying to make this work for both of us.
Absolutely.
We're trying to make it equitable.
Yeah.
I often wonder how many risk managers really know their claims managers well. They might know the underwriter well.
Yes.
But how well do they know the claims manager of their major carriers?
Yes.
From an insurance perspective, we should be party to that renewal presentation. We should, in claims, we should be part of that renewal presentation, that new business win.
Yeah.
We should be there so that when... that claim comes along, you're not meeting the risk manager for the first time.
Exactly.
It's pretty simple.
Exactly.
And if you know them and you've met them, it's a much easier conversation.
Absolutely.
When you've got the trust, confidence, consistency, it's a much easier conversation.
Absolutely.
But I don't know how many risk managers really know their claims managers of their major carriers that well.
Yeah.
Because an insured buys insurance to protect their bottom line,
yes,
and to protect their brand and reputation.
Absolutely.
So that's where an insurer has to recognise that. We have to be part of that. We've got to be involved in that from a claims perspective. We've got to recognise that ourselves.
Yep.
When I look through case law that comes out, and you look at who it is, the name of the insured,
yep,
and there's occasionally one, sometimes more than occasionally, that come out, and it will be a big name corporate.
Yes.
And it's not a great decision.
Yes.
The case law is not a good decision. I scratch my head sometimes wondering, who ran that? Did the insurer run it?
Yeah.
Because we're running it in that insured's name.
Yes.
Now, theoretically, we don't have the right to trash their name in legal case law.
Mm.
So we have to have the insured's buy-in.
Yes.
That we're going to run this.
Yes.
And then it's the second point we made earlier about ownership. Who ran it? Did the insurer run it, or did the lawyer run it and the insurer just went along with it? And then he dragged along the insured, saying, oh, well, no, it's a great argument, we're going to win, don't worry. Because it doesn't happen that way.
No.
But if you look at case law, 80-90% of it will involve an insurer.
Yeah.
And there's been a couple in the last month, I've just scratched my head and said,
wow,
who ran that?
Yeah.
I'd love to know.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that can damage a relationship.
Yeah.
If it's not done properly. I think by being involved in that renewal presentation, by having a working relationship before they have claims or before they have that claim, helps us know and understand their business. Because if you just get a claim that comes in and you think, I don't really know what this company does or why they're working in that, doing this extension or building here, that doesn't make sense. It makes it a lot harder for that person to understand the business drivers
behind it
and how such an occurrence could happen.
Yeah.
So knowing their business well, when I see risk managers outside of the renewal cycle and outside of the claim cycle purely on a relationship basis, because that's what you should be doing.
Yeah.
Brokers push for it. Brokers advocate it.
Yes.
And I, you know, it should, and it makes it easier when and when that comes along.
And why wouldn't you do it? Why wouldn't you leverage the experience, all of the knowledge of the claims manager, as well as the underwriter, as well as the broker?
Yes.
I mean, the more information, the better.
Because we're seeing, say it's a construction company, we're seeing construction claims
all the time
for other insurers.
Yep.
No, we won't name names.
Yes. Yep.
But we can actually say to them, this is our experience of what's happening here.
Exactly.
And they can say the pertinent point from that.
Yes.
Into their own and say, actually, this is happening with X, Y, Z.
Yes.
So there's a lot of cross knowledge that can be shared.
It's a little bit of that principle of risk management, you know, that external sensing that a risk manager has to do. Oh, here it is in spades. You know, the insurers are working in the space all the time.
Yeah.
Leverage their knowledge.
That's right.
You know?
That's right.
So if there was a young person looking to you for some advice about, you know, starting a career in the insurance industry, what would you talk to them about? What would you say was the opportunity?
It's quite a funny question, because I reckon 90% of people in insurance didn't start off intentionally going into insurance.
Yep.
I'm one of the few that, I mean, even I fell into it in a sense, because...
Yes.
But it wasn't my intention to. I said it wasn't what I was studying for at school or college.
Yes.
I think one of the problems is the one I raised earlier about its perception, its image, how people understand it outside of our environment.
Yes.
And also at university, I be corrected where I'm wrong, there's no formal qualification for insurance. I think Monash are doing something now that is insurancy.
Yes.
But it's really an add-on to something else.
Yes, yes.
So there's no standalone insurance qualification.
It's really actuarial or something, yeah. Isn't it? It's about the closest that it gets. Yeah.
So I think that's where it doesn't get onto people's radar.
Yes.
And because of its external perception.
Yes.
People go, oh, no, I don't know.
Yeah.
But when you actually do get talking to people about it.
Yes.
I was the other day, when I was playing golf, this guy really got interested in what we did.
Yes.
Well, he was stuck with me for the next 16 holes, so, you know, but he actually started, oh, I've never looked at it like that.
Yes.
And he was in banking and finance.
Right.
And he said, I've never looked at insurance like that. And I started giving him some examples.
Yes.
So I think if you're given the opportunity to go in and talk to people, I think, and you can give some of the examples, whether even from a trip and slip claim up to a catastrophic bushfire loss, the range within there is so great that you'd get people interested. I think if someone's coming into it, I do think obviously having a financial background or a legal background does help, and that's where most insurers are going.
Yeah.
But it's a job you learn on the job.
It's a
career you learn on the job.
Yeah.
It's where that knowledge is born. It's learning from your experience.
Yes.
So if you're willing to say, okay, I'm going to make mistakes, but I'm willing to learn from them, then you'll be fine. You're not going to get it right the whole time.
Yeah.
Not all the underwriters get it right the whole time, whether in their rating or whether they're giving this extension or that extension.
Yeah.
They don't get it right. We don't know whether we've got it right. We get a settlement.
Yeah.
And if you're unhappy about it, it's probably not a bad one. And if everybody else is unhappy about it, then it might be the right one.
Yes.
But you don't really know. No. There's no, this claim will settle for $100,000 and it settles for $150,000, so I've got it wrong.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. That's
you don't know that.
Yeah.
So I think it's an industry that is open to an awful lot of people if they really were given the opportunity to look into it. Because you get to see and understand. So there aren't many industries you can go into where you get exposed to so many different other industries.
Absolutely. The diversity is enormous.
It is.
Yeah, yeah.
Diversity of risk is phenomenal.
You're standing on a ship one day, you're at a construction site the next, it's just phenomenal.
Yeah.
No, that's great. I guess there's been a lot of discussion lately about disruption and change and transformation and all these things going on. And I'm just curious as to what you think the role of robotics and AI has in claims management.
I think the one of the challenges for insurers, I mean, firstly, I think AI and robotics is a massive opportunity for insurers.
Yes.
I think it's going to have a huge impact on the industry. On the one hand, I think it will be quite quick and it will have a big effect.
Yes.
On the other hand, there's an overall a slow creep, which I'll come on to.
Yep.
One of the challenges for insurers is really where we've underinvested in IT.
Yeah.
So to jump from our current systems, and some insurers still have legacy systems, that's a huge chain around the neck for them.
Yes.
Legacy systems that won't be able to interface properly with the technology we need for AI.
Yes.
Particularly.
Yeah.
And for robotics, but particularly AI. I think that's a challenge. So there's going to have to be a massive IT expenditure.
Yes.
It's all in motor and home, say AI is already involved.
Yes.
Really.
Yes.
But it's a slow creep. So if you look at from a claims world, AI and robotics particularly are already involved in that area. So once they've mastered motor and home claims and personal lines and the like, it will then slowly creep into the next level, which is you're going to be your SME trip and slips, your attritional account. So you can imagine an attritional account, high volume claims account, labour intensive, slow at times, regardless of it, because it is labour intensive.
Yes.
Use AI.
Yeah.
Why can't you use AI?
Yeah.
Why can't you use robotics?
Yeah.
No reason other than cost, installation, programming, and everything else.
Yes.
But that will happen.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then once you start seeing, once people start seeing the savings, I need to say the headcount savings.
Yes.
But the savings on and the improvement on efficiency.
Yes.
It's going to happen. That also. So you then say, okay, well, it's now doing nutritional losses.
Yep.
Where do we go next?
Yeah.
Personal injury, worker to worker. Where do we go next?
Yeah.
Where does it go? So it's just going to be this slow creep.
Yeah.
Up through the layers of complexities.
Yes.
But the problem with that is then you then take out relationships.
Yeah.
Which is one of the foundations of the insurance industry.
Yeah.
So that is something I'm not sure how that's going to be.
Yeah.
But obviously, as the more you invest, the better the headcount issue, the greater the efficiency, the more your competitors are doing it, and you're losing competition as a result of your competitors doing it.
Yes.
You know, the you can just see how that's going to evolve.
It's
going
to be challenging.
It's going to be challenging. If you look at, there's an insurer in the UK that has already got robots reading lawyers' reports.
Oh,
now,
really?
What they do is they just grab the data.
Yep.
So they grab the data. There's an accident at shopping centre, Bondi.
Yep.
Female, 54. Grab the reserve. Grab the other relevant information.
Yep.
Puts it in the system, that's it.
Yep.
Right. It can do that in seconds, under 10 seconds.
Yes.
But that report by a human is 15 minutes.
Yes. Yeah.
Multiply that X number of times.
Yes.
You can see where that's going to go. So it's grabbing the data, it's putting it into the system. Now, AI, so if you get a statement of claiming,
yep.
Artificial intelligence will be able to tell you now, when you've got the statement of claiming for that lady, 54-year-old, Bondi,
yep.
And it will be able to tell you, well, based on this, plaintiff lawyers,
yes,
who they are,
yep.
Right? He will tell you when you're going to settle,
yep.
And how much for.
Yep.
So, again, multiply that and put it into your actuarial and loss ratio.
Yep.
You can see, okay, we've now got this account really under control. We know where it's going. It's indisputable data.
Yes, yes.
Really.
Yep.
And then come renewal, everyone will say, well, we know where it is. This, and
yeah, it's quite, that's industry changing.
It's industry changing.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think parts of that's going to happen quite quickly.
Yes, yes.
There is an appetite. If you can get around the technology side,
yes.
There's an appetite for it to happen. It will reduce costs. It will impact relationships.
Yes.
And I think that is something that we have to be very cautious on in terms of how does that... are we really moving to purely transactional business?
Yeah.
Is that where we're going? Is insurance going to become purely transactional? To an extent, that is what's happening.
Mm.
If you look at a recent one like Cyclone Debbie,
yes.
Now, most insurers had a fleet of loss adjusters swarming around Queensland.
Yes,
that's pretty archaic and draconian, really, isn't it?
Yes,
it's a highly inefficient system.
Yep.
Again, we should be able to tell that properties on that street had X amount of water. It is rainwater, fine, it's flooded, it came up to here, they had, therefore that would have impacted these level of goods in their house, and this amount of damage would have occurred, and therefore that equals Y.
Yep.
You've got a hydrologist, that's all AI'd as well.
Yep.
You don't need a loss adjuster.
No.
You just need a desktop person to do the analysis.
Yep.
Everything else fits into place and you process it.
Yeah.
And the person gets their check really quickly.
Yes.
You're not waiting for a load of loss adjusters who've got too many claims because they rightly can't resource for Cyclone Debbie coming in.
No, that's right.
And that's taking weeks, and they've got to get all the hydrologists' reports and everybody else to fit in, and insurers are saying, sorry, I haven't got the experts.
And in the meantime, someone's on Today Tonight saying, look at me, I've got nowhere to live, and
yep.
the insurers,
they came last Wednesday.
Yep. And I still haven't seen them.
Yep. And they've not sent me a cheque.
Yes.
So you can see that.
Yep.
And I thought Debbie was quite a rude awakening for how far we hadn't got.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
There were loss adjusters out there, and they were using drones.
Yes.
But there's privacy issues.
Yes. Yeah.
Around where you can use drones. So you can't... We need to work out how we can use that in an emergency. We saw it in the recent storms in the US. Lots of drone footage.
Yes.
Great.
Yes.
And that's... You can see that being used properly.
Yeah.
And efficiently means that we as an industry are just going to be able to move...
A lot quicker. Yeah.
Robotics is an interesting one where... The workforce is being replaced by robots. There is a port, I can't remember which one it is, there's a port in Asia somewhere that operates 24/7 in the dark.
Right.
All by robots.
Right. Wow.
And so they have zero accidents.
Yes.
It's all robots.
No industrial action.
No industrial action.
Yep.
Fewer injuries.
Yes.
Improved risk.
Yep.
Now, the challenge for us as an insurer is where it's not all robots,
yep.
And you've got that human and robot interface.
Yeah.
So it's a claims challenge because we've got to develop a new skill of understanding what the robots were supposed to be doing. Did the human get in the wrong way? Was the robot wrongly programmed?
Yes.
Was, you know, simple things like, I don't know.
Yes.
But you can just see how that's going to be the next... phase, a bit like on motor insurance with driverless cars.
Yes. Yeah, is the risk actually transferring into something more related to a cyber risk?
Yes.
Yeah.
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 That's right. And then I think in conjunction with all of that, there's straight-through processing, which everybody, you know, understands of a claim being made.
Yeah.
It's valid, it's checked, and out it goes. There's no human touch.
Yes.
Because that is what, in some respects, certainly on the personal lines area, people are expecting.
Yes.
And if you take the Cyclone Debbie approach, yes.
Yeah.
Interestingly, out of just thinking back to the Brisbane floods, I can't remember the statistic, but it was something like 70%, 80% of people who were underinsured had taken up online insurance directly themselves.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so... When you're doing it online, you think, well, I can save $10 if I say my sum insured should be this rather than the higher figure.
Yes.
And of course, it should have been the higher figure.
Yes. And all of a sudden, they're wondering why.
They're underinsured.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
So those are the challenges around AI and robotics. And I guess just finally, and I've taken a lot of your time, but just finally the. Challenges to the industry more broadly, generally, for insurance? Are there things in the next sort of 3 to 5 years that are, you know, going to be a challenge for the industry? Are there things in the next 3 to 5 years that are, you know, opportunities and bright lights on the horizon?
I think the regulation changes and legislation changes are always out there for insurers. They're always
yes.
concerned.
Yes.
Recently in Queensland, they brought in the industrial manslaughter.
Yes.
Excluding mining.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's as a result of the Ardent Leisure Dreamworld disaster.
Yeah.
Again, it's kind of taking that blame culture to the corporatized, and they've had corporate manslaughter in the UK for many years now.
Yes.
But I think it's seen upon slightly differently. But the one, certainly for Queensland, and they've... Yeah, it's going to be brought into other states, I would imagine.
Yeah.
That's a concern in the sense of where does it fit? Where do those costs fit?
Yeah.
Are they liability costs in the defence of?
Yeah.
Where it would be a criminal prosecution, so... D&O.
Yeah.
Is that really the intent of a D&O policy?
Yeah.
So those sort of changes. So we've got to be able to be innovative in our insurance products.
Yes.
That's a challenge in the next few years.
Yes.
Being innovative in our insurance products for what is reasonably a new world order.
Yeah.
On the back of that, as a claims manager, you've then got to have people who are skilled in that area. No one at the moment can claim to be a cyber claim expert.
No.
So how do you market that?
Yep.
How do we go to say, well, we've got people who are knowledgeable,
they're
skilled, they understand, but you can't say you're an expert.
No.
And then it's the same with the robotics, as we were talking about, and driverless cars.
Yes.
So there's a lot in the claims world we've got to work out how we manage it, how do we market it? Because we've got to be able to back end those innovative products that are coming in.
Yeah.
Disruption continues to be a challenge for the industry.
Yep.
I really don't see that changing. I like the example of the UK motor insurer who you can download an app. You register your car, all your details and everything else. You have the app on when you're driving, and your insurance, you are on cover for the time you're driving.
Right.
So as long as you've got the phone with the app on, you're covered.
Yep.
And when it's sitting in your garage, obviously you've got fire and theft cover separately.
Yep.
But you're not. So you're only paying when you are
paying
for use.
Yeah.
And it's so simple. It's such a simple no-brainer thing, isn't it?
Yes.
And I'd imagine that to an extent that will come up through into the corporate world in different ways.
Yes.
But that an increased competition, dealing with legacy systems so that we can move with the technology that's going to be required in the AI robotics area. Predicting the market cycle is difficult.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing rates increasing in property. We're seeing D&O rates increasing. There's challenges around D&O in the sense of where the new limit is going to be, how they're going to self-insure that.
Yes.
Does that change risk management within that corporatisation when they take on themselves? Climate and weather events, that's certainly not going to change. And if you look at the Q3 results for everyone that's come out in the last month, there aren't many insurers that have escaped a negative
weather event.
And how that's impacted the market.
Yeah.
So, if you have that continued, that's going to impact. You've got no control over that. Really, risk selection, geographical selection, perhaps, but it would be very limiting if you pulled out of everywhere.
Yes.
And as a global insurer, you've got to be in the market. And you never know where all your clients' goods are at any one time. And the other thing I think, and we've mentioned it a couple of times, and this may just be me being concerned about it, is the relationships. I think there's this going to be, as we move into this new world, into the seamless insurance transactional space, where that impacts relationships, whether it's with clients, whether it's with brokers.
Yes.
Because if you take that out, it's becoming a very numeric industry, purely based on data, and big data isn't something I've covered really today, but big data is one of those big scary things that's out there.
Yes.
That every claims manager tries to work out what we should be doing with it. I was asked the other day, what do you do with all your management information?
And it was
a good question.
Yeah.
We sit, we look at it, we manage it, we review it, we challenge it. But we've got to be able to do more, and I think able to do more is probably more in that AI space in the future, because it will tell us what we're really looking at.
Listen, I think you're right, and I think in an industry where contracts are very key, you know, there's lots of paper-based processes, or at least, you know, forms and documents, you know, you start to wonder about things like blockchain and those sort of things. And you wonder whether, you know, the optimistic view hopefully would be that all of those things that bring some of those efficiencies mean you've got more time for the relationship and you actually get to know the organisation and its risk and its processes. Now, you know.
And contracts is a good, is a really good point, because if you're using contracts throughout your business, and say you're a construction company or something similar, you've probably got the standard templates.
Yes.
But through AI, and you've got, you'd have your contract out there, and everyone will know what it says.
Yes.
And it's not disputable, it can't be disputed.
Yep.
And it makes our life as an insurer a lot easier, because we're not debating whether you applied this contract or that contract and it wasn't signed and it wasn't this and it wasn't in force.
Yep.
You know, and the number of times we've seen claims win and lost on a comma in the wrong spot.
A technicality, yep.
A contract not being signed.
Yes.
Therefore, you go to what was on, you know, the terms and conditions signed on the back of the docket. We've got nowhere to go.
Yes.
We've got nowhere to go, and it hurts. I mean, if I often talk about contract certainty or contract integrity.
Yes.
The greater the strength of that contract,
yes,
the more I will save on my legal spend.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I've had clients in the past where they've had a claim, and I'll say, oh, well, that's with that client, that contract, and everybody, their supply chain up and down. They know what it says. They know how it operates. It won't be challenged. The only reason it will be challenged is if someone has to go and outsource it to a lawyer to have a look at it to see if there's a way they might be able to weave through its terms and conditions. Whereas if we've got that certainty, I can sit there and say, that's great. This is going to save me a lot of money in my legal spend.
Yes.
The amount insurers spend on legals arguing about contracts and what they should have said or what they didn't say and what we think they said and what the intention was, it's a lot of money.
The winner's the legal profession. I think you're right. I think that's one of the promising things about blockchain, forgetting the bitcoins and the, you know, all the cryptocurrencies. But if you start to get contract clarity and certainty and documentation that, you know, there is no black and white, there is no grey, it's black and white, that's what the contract says, or that's what the document says.
Yeah, it would be great to have some sort of knock-for-knock agreement on all of those.
Yes.
Because if you advocated it with all the other insurers and said, we could save a lot of money, legal spend on this, and if we put in a knock-for-knock agreement on all of these and just say, look, we'll just wear our own exposure proportionately.
Yes.
And you wear yours.
Yes.
And we won't try and do dual insurance.
Yes.
We won't try and argue any contractual indemnities.
Yes.
We'll just accept what's there.
Yep. Yeah.
That would be great.
It would.
It's unlikely, though.
We can only do it. David, listen, thank you very much. I think I've taken more than enough of your time. It's been a fascinating discussion, and I really appreciate you sparing me some time this morning to have this chat. I think it was great for people to understand a bit more about the insurer's view of the world and how it tees in with risk management. Hopefully our CRO and Head of Risk audience out there has found it very useful.
Yeah.
I'll just give the HDI website. It's www.hdi.global. If you want to look at the HDI website, find out a little bit more about the organisation. I have the advantage of having a brochure here and can see a lot about the organisation, and it's well worth having a look at as an insurance buyer or risk manager. The organisation obviously does a good job across a number of lines. So thank you again, David.
Pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you to the listeners for today. Hopefully you found today's session very interesting and as interesting as I have. We will have another guest soon. We'll certainly do one before Christmas. And I'm very pleased to say it's going to be my first female guest in the risk industry. So it's probably been a bit of a while coming, but I'm looking forward to that. So hopefully that will happen soon and you'll hear that one before Christmas. So again, I'm Anthony Wilson. If you need to talk to me, I'm on anthony.w@proximityriskassurance.com.au or 0404 829 040. Thanks for your time. Bye.